Chapter 1.
I heard you died,
said Breck, laconically. He stood looking down at me with a wry smile, his flaxen blonde hair in disarray. The cracked ice intensity of his blue eyes was heightened by his use of Bang, a hybrid plant developed from a mutated strain of non-carcinogenic tobacco and an off-world herb called Bengala. Smoking it had the effect of stimulating adrenaline production, increasing visual acuity, and amplifying tactile perceptions. Smoking Bang would make an ordinary human being burn out and self-destruct, but then Breck wasn't an ordinary human being. Prolonged use of Bang also had the curious side effect of making the eyes lambent. With Breck, whose hybrid matrix gave him cat's eyes to begin with, had the disconcerting effect of making his eyes strobe when the light hit them just right.
Shall we drink to my demise?
I said, sitting up slowly and rubbing my temples. I glanced around at the scan team and noticed that they weren't the same psycho-cybernetic engineers who were on duty when Coles brought me out of the hallucinact.
How long have I been down, Cass?
I asked the crew chief.
About 8 hours,
she said.
Nothing like a good night's sleep,
I said, though, strictly speaking, downtime wasn't really sleep. It was a psycho-cybernetic trance state, a way to turn people off when you didn't really need them for anything.
So what's the prognosis, Miss Daniels? My reading's all okay? Nothing in the red? No maintenance service required?
No therapy is indicated,
she said, consulting my chart printout.
I'd advise against consuming alcoholic beverages, though I doubt you'd listen. At least try to stop short of getting completely intoxicated. It really throws the readings off.
I stared at her and mentally undressed her. She was wearing a loose-fitting white laboratory jumpsuit, but one of the monitor screens behind her suddenly showed her standing there in a sheer black lycra bra and bikini panties, dark stockings, and spike heels. I wasn't online, so the image stayed in the control room, but it wouldn't have been broadcast anyway. Not even psycho-cybernetic engineers can totally control the output of a human mind, at least not yet. So there's always a slight delay between the biochip reception and the tachyon broadcast, allowing for some highly sophisticated editing. One of the other engineers cleared his throat softly. She turned around, saw the screen, and raised an eyebrow.
You flatter me, O'Toole,
she said in a disinterested, clinical sort of tone.
Unfortunately, I'm not quite as narrow-waisted as you seem to imagine. The result of a sedentary job with too little time for exercise, I'm afraid. And aside from considerations of style, if I were to wear shoes like that, it would lead to serious orthopedic problems.
The image on the screen broke up into snow briefly before resolving itself once more into what I actually saw before me. An attractive and apparently completely humorless young woman in a white laboratory jumpsuit. It's hard to maintain a decent fantasy without at least some cooperation.
Besides,
she said, and for a moment I could have sworn I saw the barest trace of a smile.
You left out my tattoo.
She isn't normally so personable,
Breck said as we were leaving.
I think she rather likes you.
You really think she has a tattoo?
I said.
A black king scorpion on her left inner thigh,
Breck said, with a perfectly straight face. I stopped and stared at him.
Only joking,
Breck said, with a smile.
For all I know, it's ein snake und dagger on her biceps. However, I would resist the temptation to find out for sure if I were you. Considering her position, she probably knows more about you than you know about yourself.
That's a large part of what makes it so tempting,
I said, grinning. Breck sighed.
Ah, you still have a great deal to learn, O'Toole.
He was undoubtedly right. Compared to Breck, I was a rank beginner at the game. Unfortunately, novices tend to make mistakes, and Psychodrome can be very unforgiving. My involvement started as an accident, perhaps even a lucky accident. The jury was still out on that one. I was born on Mars, in Bradbury City, Irish on my father's side, Russian on my mother's. My father was a hard-drinking, hard-gaming, two-fisted wild man named Sean O'Toole. My mother, Irina, was a long-suffering, self-effacing, beautiful and moody woman who believed that nothing really good would ever happen to her until she hit the afterlife, and even then, who knew? My dad was ruled by leprechauns, and she was spooked by generations of Russian Orthodox archbishops. A mismatch of a marriage, if ever there was one, but it lasted due to equal parts of stubbornness and love. As a result of this somewhat unlikely mixture, I never did get settled all the way. Archbishops and little people don't get along too well. The Irish part of me believed in luck, but my Russian half kept telling me I'd never get it. I came to Earth as a freshly mustered out serviceman looking for some fun on Tokyo's Ginza Strip. I suppose I must have had some, because the morning after I arrived, I woke up in a junk town slum with almost all of my money gone, a tattoo of a dragon, never mind where, and a brand new wife who was perhaps all of 14. As things turned out, the marriage wasn't legal because Miko and her family were non-regs. If you're non-registered, then you're not legally a citizen and you haven't any rights. How can you have rights if you don't exist? Of course, I didn't know about that then, because on Mars and on the Outworlds, people are still too valuable a commodity to ignore. Only Mother Earth neglects her children. All I knew is that I had, as my father would have said, really farted during Vespers this time. I've been in straits considerably more dire since, but at the time, things seemed pretty grim. And they proceeded to get grimmer. I'd always been a hustler, but unlike my dear father, roast his soul, I was strictly small time. The terrifying prospect of living out the remainder of my days in Junktown, saddled with a child wife and her starving non-reg family, made me throw caution to the winds. I did what any self-respecting Irishman would do when he was truly up against it. I went looking for a game of poker. I found one, and I made a very serious mistake. I won. I know it flies in the face of logic, but there is such a thing as a hot streak. Most gamblers live for it. However, if you're not very careful, it can utterly destroy you. I don't know what causes it, but when it strikes, you know it without the faintest scintilla of a doubt. It's magic. It's as if a ghostly finger taps on the shoulder and the voice of fate whispers in your ear.
Okay, kid. This is it. It's your turn to be God.
At any other time, I would have known better and exercised restraint. But at any other time, I wouldn't have been there to begin with. Those guys were way too heavy for me. The secret to handling a hot streak and coming out ahead is knowing when to stop. It's a principle that every gambler knows. However, there is a lesser-known corollary that separates the winners from the losers in the long run, and in some cases, it separates the living from the dead. Unless you're in a huge casino, which likes to have a big winner now and then because it draws in all the losers, don't ever win too big. Engrave that on your greedy little heart. The smart hustler is not a barracuda. He lives on little bites. He just moves around it and makes a lot of them. I wasn't smart. I knew that I was on a streak, and I got greedy, and I bit off a lot more than I could chew. The guy who got chewed up the worst was a sore loser named Hakim Sakara, who just happened to be a warlord of the Yakuza. If I'd known that then when I took his money, I probably would have committed harikiri on the spot. I would have saved everyone a lot of time and trouble. If he felt like it, he could have had me killed that very night. But I had pricked his pride, and he wanted to draw his satisfaction out a bit. He decided to continue the game, so to speak, away from the table. So he waited. He gave me the time to parlay my winnings into a comfortable lifestyle. The money I pulled off him allowed me to buy citizen registrations for Miko and her family, and loan her enough funds to buy an education so she could get a job. I never thought I'd see it back, but I didn't really give a damn. I had a run of bad luck, and I somehow managed to turn it all around. Then Sakara made his move and gave me an education in major league hustling that I'll never forget. By the time he was finished with me, I was so well and truly on the hook to him that when he snapped his fingers, I was in the air before he finished saying jump. He took me for everything I had. In the process, I learned a bit too much about him. So when he decided I had nothing left to lose and could be no further use to him, he told his boys to drop me in the bay. Without a doubt, I would have wound up fish food if the leprechauns hadn't delivered a miracle. My number was selected in the Psychodrome lottery. Now, Psychodrome was never my idea of entertainment. I found reality challenging enough, thank you. I didn't need fantasy tripping. I hadn't even bought the damn ticket. Before we parted company, my wife, Miko, once mentioned picking up a couple of tickets for us, and I'd forgotten all about it until mine was drawn for the grand prize, a chance to play an adventure game scenario with a couple of Psychodrome's hottest stars. There I was, trying to hide out from Yakuza assassins, and the next thing I knew, I was famous. All I wanted was to go someplace where no one knew my name, and suddenly, everybody knew my name. I didn't have a lot of options. I was broke, without even enough money to buy another meal. I'd been all the way up and down the scale. I'd gone from an ex-serviceman with some money to burn to a pauper down in Junktown to a high roller on the Ginza Strip to a stockbroker in Hamamatsu. And then the downward slide had started as Sakara wrapped his tentacles around me, and in 5 short years, I was right back where I'd started. No worse off than before, except for one slight detail. There was a contract out on me. Psychodrome was a way out. If I had known back then what I was letting myself in for, I might have stayed in Tokyo and taken my chances with the Yakuza. There were different levels to the game known as the Ultimate Experience. Some of them provided harmless fantasies built around luxury and pleasure, whatever turns you on. Others provided adventure, challenge, and great risk. Players rich enough to afford the entry fees could choose their own scenarios from the adventures Psychodrome had to offer. The less fortunate could buy tickets in the lottery, with the grand prize being a chance to play. However, there was a catch. Winners of the lottery didn't get to choose their game scenarios, and they had no control over their experiences. In that respect, there were 2 levels to Psychodrome. One in which wealthy players got to use the game for interactive, exhibitionist entertainment, and one in which the game got to use the players. Those who fell into the latter category were generally die-hard thrill-seekers, gamblers, or desperate individuals. In other words, people very much like me. And there's never been a shortage of such people. Players about to embark upon the ultimate experience were taken to the headquarters of Psychodrome International, the mega-corporate entity which operates the game. There, the prospective player was given a full medical and psychological examination, and a definitive player database was assembled. The player was then taken into surgery, where a special semi-organic psycho-cybernetic biochip was implanted in the cerebral cortex. Permanently. You couldn't take it out, even if you could afford psycho-cybernetic surgery. The chip grew directly into the brain matter, like a rooting seedling. It gave the player the ability to interface directly with the Psychodrome computer banks, as well as with Psychodrome's Player Master satellite network. The game began when the players were transported to a selected location where they were supposed to interact with people and situations they encountered in order to achieve specific game objectives. It was possible to win, but still more possible to lose. And losing could mean death, which made for great entertainment, you see. The game scenarios could be located anywhere on Earth or on another world or from a fantasy hallucinac devised by Psychodrome. In other words, it could be real or a programmed hallucination. Only the Player Master knew for sure. As the players pursued their game objectives, the Player Master was capable of interfacing with them to provide guidance or game clues, but never direct assistance. If you got into a jam, it was up to you to figure out how to get out of it. And the fun part was that the Player Master satellite network enabled instantaneous tachyon transmission of your experiences to Psychodrome Game Control for broadcast on mass media Psych Fidelity Entertainment channels. People using their sci-fi sets at home could follow the adventures of their favorite players and experience the game with them by plugging into the net. Sci-fi entertainment systems allowed them to achieve an electronic sensory link with the players. Each player's experience was broadcast on a separate channel of the system. By switching channels, the home audience could switch players, vicariously becoming those players. Sort of like renting somebody else's body to have a fantasy adventure, sharing all the sensory experiences from the safety of your own living room. Or bedroom. Like I said, whatever turns you on. And if things got a bit too hairy, the fail-safe biomonitors built into the system would protect you from becoming too excited. Home players were also capable of some limited interaction with the players by voting on selected game options. The vote was electronically tallied and the results instantaneously transmitted to the players via tachyon beam. The players then had the option of following the advice of the home audience or not. However, since ratings were important, there was a certain amount of pressure on the players to please the audience, and they could be a bit bloodthirsty on occasion. Realized game objectives resulted in fabulous cash prizes, as did accumulated experience points. Psychodrome professionals, psychos, were cult figures living out a life of fantasy most people could only dream about or experience vicariously. It wasn't the sort of career I would have selected for myself, but as someone once said, life is just what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. Besides, what gambler can resist the lure of a big game? And though Psychodrome seemed to be the biggest game around, it turned out there was an even bigger game being played out behind the scenes. The clandestine game that Coles seemed to be running. I'd always assumed that there was someone running Coles, because the thought of Coles being accountable to no one but himself was a bit too unsettling to deal with. There had to be an order to things. Even Einstein had insisted that God didn't play dice with the universe. Of course, Einstein dealt with things on a far larger scale than I did, but if Coles wasn't God in my own small corner of the universe, he certainly was one of his four horsemen. He was one of them, the mysterious and omnipotent they you're always hearing about. The ones who run things, the ones with all the power. He appeared out of nowhere, waltzed right into game control, and started giving orders. I'd always wondered about Psychodrome International wiring all those people up. The biochip was presented to the world as the latest thing in cybertech, a boon to all humanity. There was nothing like a brain-computer interface for increasing human potential. Take a short nap and wake up with your college education, or fluency in a foreign language, or have yourself programmed with an advanced-level technical course. All you had to do was pay for the data, competitively priced, the computer time, expensive, and the implantation of a biochip, a mere king's ransom. The operation was a relatively simple one for a psycho-cybernetic surgeon to perform, and the actual cost of manufacturing a biochip, even allowing for a whopping profit, was still considerably less than what they charged. But then when something is ruinously expensive, it becomes that much more desirable to those who can afford it, namely the rich and powerful, the movers and the shakers. If you want to hook that crowd, price your product accordingly, and they'll line up for blocks to get one. And if you offer it as a grand prize in a glamorous lottery, a prize that not only lets you participate in the adventure of a lifetime, but gives you a biochip to keep forever as a souvenir, something that can increase your life potential, providing you can have it programmed, well, you can sell all the tickets you can print. Everybody, but everybody, played the lottery. However, on the other hand, inevitably, over a period of time, you'd have more and more people with biochips permanently implanted in their brains, which not only allowed their minds to interface with the computer, but could also conceivably allow someone to broadcast coded signals to their biochips and access their minds without their even knowing it. Of course, only a paranoid would think like that. Enter Mr. Coles. I never would have met Coles or learned how insidious Psychodrome could be if it hadn't been for a gaming round that took me to a planet called Draconis 9. The dominant form of life on Draconis 9 were creatures known as ambimorphs. In other words, shape changers. The first corporate development team to set foot on Draconis 9 did what humans always do whenever they encounter a new wilderness. They started killing things. Until the humans came, the ambimorphs were simple creatures who survived by instinct. But after ignorant humans started killing them, the ambimorphs' instinct for survival led them to imitate the strange new predators. They took human form and mutated in the process, becoming sentient. And that's when they became a real problem. Breck had been with a special service unit sent to rescue the humans on Draconis 9. The mission had been a miserable failure. There had been no way to differentiate between the humans and the shape-changers. The ambimorphs were one-way telepaths. They communicated by reading one another's minds. And their shape-changing was more than superficial. They not only took on human form, they became human. They were so plastic a life form that one of them could read my mind and take my shape and become completely indistinguishable from me. It would sound like me. It would act like me. It would know everything I knew. It would duplicate my biology and essentially become another me. And it could take any other form at will, with lightning speed. No one knew how they could do it. No ambimorph had ever been captured alive and studied. Dead ambimorphs did not revert back to whatever their natural form was. They became fixed somehow in whatever shape they had taken on before they died, and even a detailed autopsy could not penetrate the secret of their morphology. They had been harmless, uncomplicated, unreasoning beings with a bovine placidity until they encountered us. Then, just to survive, they changed and became the most terrifying life form in the universe, chameleons with human cunning and, worse still, human instincts. We had created the enemy and he was us, only it was a superior design. Draconis 9 was quarantined. A military base was established in orbit above the planet to maintain the quarantine, and it might have ended there, except that there was something on Draconis 9 that people wanted. Fire crystals. Demand for the crystals as rare, ornamental, and industrial gems led to the formation of the Draconis Combine, a multinational conglomerate with enough clout to circumvent the quarantine and establish orbital habitats above Draconis 9, housing a new species of professional who was part adventurer, part gambler, part mercenary, and part scum, the Crystal Hunters. They went down to the surface of Draconis to hunt their crystals and kill each other to protect their digs and annihilate anything living that came close to them, just in case it was an ambimorph. They went down equipped with state-of-the-art weapons and skimmer sleds and specially coded transceivers so they could be scanned when they came back, have their humanity verified, be placed into protective quarantine, and exhaustively examined just to make sure no ambimorphs got through. Well, it didn't work. The shape-changers broke the quarantine. Coles, in his infinite deviousness, had directed Psychodrome to announce the creation of a brand new continuing adventure game scenario. Coming up soon, Alien Invasion. Tune in and share the fantasy. Stalk the ambimorphs who walk among us. Join the elite team mobilized to save the human race. It was billed as the most realistic game scenario the company had ever run, and only a small group of people knew that it was real. Trust Coles to find the perfect way to desensitize the public to an alien invasion. Make it into a media event. Breck and I were part of an inner group of psychos answering only to Coles. I don't recall ever being asked to join. At first, it scared me silly, and then I started to get excited about it. I tried to sell myself that it was only my gambler's instinct responding to a challenge, the lure of the big game, the charge and laying it all right on the line. I really wanted to believe that, but there was a little chip inside my brain, a miracle of modern psycho-cybernetic engineering. Never since they'd put it in there, I never really knew for sure where my ideas came from anymore. But of course, psychos aren't supposed to let things like that bother them. Breck lit up a bang stick and leaned back in his chair, inhaling the vaguely minty smoke and holding it in his lungs a moment before exhaling slowly. He claimed the devilish stuff actually relaxed him. I tried not to inhale too deeply. The last thing I needed was a contact adrenaline rush that would make me start climbing up the walls. Breck ordered a beer and I asked the waitress for an Irish whiskey. It was ruinously expensive, what with the import tariffs, but there was simply no adequate domestic substitute. Just as there was no adequate substitute for cocktail waitresses. The unemployment statistics being what they were, any service establishment using robotics was liable to get boycotted, if not trashed. So most places in the city had disposed of their robots and gone back to using human help, and they made an astonishing discovery. People actually preferred being waited on by people. There were fewer mistakes involved in taking orders. It made the atmosphere more congenial, and customers were far less likely to assault a human waiter than to demolish a robot server. So the overhead went down. Besides, no robot could beat a cocktail waitress with great legs. Solo's wasn't very crowded yet. The action didn't really pick up until after midnight, so we didn't draw a great deal of attention. Breck only signed about 10 or 15 autographs. I signed 5, but then I wasn't as big a star as Breck was. Not that I minded very much. I watched the way they approached him. The expressions on their faces, a mixture of awe, lust, and envy. It made me nervous. It's only natural to want people to like you, to accept you for who and what you are, but you want it on your terms. You want to be able to decide how much of yourself you're going to reveal at any given time, and you want to control how close you're going to let other people get. Psychos didn't really get to do that. We had more than just a sensory link with the home audience. We had an emotional link as well. It wasn't true telepathy, but someone plugging into the net and tuning in a psycho often got more than just sight, sound, smell, and feel. Some psychos projected better than others. There was a greater sense of empathy. Apparently, I let a great deal of myself seep through, and people who tuned in on me not only got the sensation of sharing my experiences, they got a strong sense of what it felt like to be me. I found that out the hard way. I'd fallen in love with Stone Winters and kept it to myself, but when she plugged into a rerun of one of our adventures and tuned me in so that she could see how their game partner reacted, she experienced my feelings about her. And during the broadcast, so did everybody else who tuned me in. I started receiving fan mail from women who liked the way my feelings felt. It was embarrassing, to say the least, but there was nothing I could do about it. Blame it on my heritage, I was apparently one hell of an emoter. Breck was different. Rudy was larger than life. He gave them a sense of what it felt like to be a hero, a swashbuckler who quite literally knew no fear. He was immensely popular because he gave his audience a chance to experience what it felt like to have power in their world. It wasn't really theirs. It was Rudy's. But for a while, they got to share it with him. It made their desperate working lives a bit more bearable. Perhaps that was a good thing in some respects, beneficial therapy, but on the other hand, coming home from a long grind at the office and becoming Rudy Breck was a heady experience. Someone who did not possess Breck's physical perfection, his superior hybrid strength and reflexes, his leap into the jaws of death and devil and take the hindmost approach to life could tune him in and get a fix of what that felt like, only with safety valves incorporated into the delusion. No real danger, no real stress, no risk, no pain, no gamble. It could be incredibly addictive, turning people into passive receptors, dreamers whose fantasies became more than real to them, more meaningful than the lives they actually led. It was both sad and scary, and I was part of it, somewhere in the middle, not quite sure where I fit in.
"You're looking very pensive," Breck said, glancing at me over his beer glass.
I tossed back the whiskey. I'd promised myself I wouldn't drink anymore, but an Irishman trying not to drink is like a politician trying to be sincere. It's against the laws of nature.
I was thinking about the life we lead, I said.
It doesn't really belong to us, does it? It belongs to Coles. It belongs to the company. It belongs to the audience. To everyone except us.
Breck made a wry face.
You're not going to get drunk again, are you, O'Toole? You always become maudlin when you're drunk.
I sighed. I'm just tired, Rudy. I don't think that I've had more than 6 hours to myself since I got back from Tokyo. If Coles wasn't running us ragged, he's got me on downtime, or he's staging hallucinacs, which I'm dying half the time, and I can't tell the difference between what's real and what isn't anymore. I'm on the verge of overload. And in answer to your question, yes, I'm going to get drunk.
There's nothing more tedious than someone who's half Russian, half Irish, and all drunk,
said Breck.
The last time you were in your cups, you got up on a table and make an incomprehensible speech about the virtues of ethical conduct. Then you sang a little song, received a great deal of applause, and passed out on the floor. I had to carry you home and put you in bed. I wouldn't have minded so much if I hadn't been reprimanded by Coles for not keeping a tighter rein on you. As if that were my responsibility.
A man's gotta unwind somehow, I said weakly.
Yeah, unwind, not cease running altogether,
Breck said. He pointed his index finger at me.
I'm watching you this time, O'Toole. The minute you start running your sentences together, I'm cutting off your booze.
He doesn't do it to you, does he? Breck frowned.
Who doesn't do what to me? What are you talking about?
Coles. Who else?
Ah, the hallucinac training sessions, you mean?
He shook his head.
Nine. He's been having scum crews working round the clock, debriefing me, trying to prime my subconscious so they can reconstruct that miserable mission to Draconis 9 all those years ago. It's an experience I dearly wish I could forget, and he's been making me relive it. All he's doing to you is trying to bring you up to speed, something you should probably thank him for, believe it or not. it will increase your survivability quotient, as he puts it. Bureaucrats seem to have a language all their own, don't they? In any case, back up! At least you still managed to retain your sanity. That puts you ahead of the game.
You could die playing this game,
I said.
And I sure don't feel like I'm ahead. I feel as if I'm losing touch with my own reality.
I drained the glass and ordered another whiskey.
On the contrary,
Breck said.
Your own reality is the one thing you're not losing touch with. Do you remember the advice I gave you when we first met? You were worried about how to tell if what you were about to experience would be real or a programmed hallucination. And I told you not to concern yourself with that. To treat each and every experience as if it were absolutely real. Because if you allowed yourself the luxury of doubt, your mind would cling to that doubt in the moments of extreme stress. And that could kill you.
I nodded.
I remember. I didn't even know the half of it then.
What happened in your last hallucinact?
Said Breck.
The ambimorph got me,
I said, staring down at the table.
I screwed up, and I died.
But did you ever doubt that you were really about to die?
I frowned and shook my head.
No, it seemed so real.
Precisely,
Breck said.
Even after repeated training sessions in psycho-cybernetic computer simulations designed to subject your mind to continually increased levels of stress, you still maintained your grasp on your perceived reality. You stayed grounded, in other words. You did not retreat into denial. Even faced with what appeared to be imminent death, you continued to integrate your perceptions into your own reality instead of allowing your sense of reality to disintegrate.
I stared at him. But don't crazy people do the exact same thing? If what you perceive isn't real, and you act on that, is that sanity? Breck smiled.
It depends on how you respond to what you perceive,
he said.
Schizophrenics, for example, tend to have completely unpredictable responses. If you react to your sensory input in a normal manner, it doesn't matter if your perceptions are based on something that isn't real. The brain is essentially a computer. And a computer is only as good as its input. If Coles inputs in a hallucinact in which you are about to die, what matters is how you react to that situation, not whether or not the situation is actually real. Because your perceptions are all you have to go on. You might say an hallucinact bypasses your reality circuit. Since it's the only input you're receiving, it becomes the only reality you can respond to.
You mean as in garbage in, garbage out?
That's a peculiar way of putting it, but in principle it's essentially correct. Another way to look at it is to think of it as problem solving. Our life is, after all, is a series of problems that we have to solve. Hallucinact is merely a model of the real thing. Both requires the same problem solving approach. However, if you ever start to result your own perceptions questioning your input, then that becomes the equivalent of ignoring the problem. That doesn't mean it's going to go away.
I understand that part of it, I said.
What has me worried is that Cole seemed intent on confusing my sense of reality. He sent us out on a real-life experience, and he'll program a hallucinact that mimics that reality, and I never know which one it will be.
But you believe that it doesn't really matter?
Now that's crazy, I said.
Not from his point of view,
Breck said with a shrug.
The most effective way of training someone to cope with life-or-death situations is to place them in life-or-death situations. That's why the Asian martial arts purists always trained with real-edged weapons, and why this precious service always trains with live ammo. Cause is getting you accustomed to facing death. Once you become accustomed to it, the threat itself doesn't always affect your response time anymore. It's a rather novel way to use hallucinacts. The service should probably look into it. It's certainly more economical than going on maneuvers.
But if I keep encountering life-threatening situations in Hallucinax and waking up to find out that it was all a psycho-cybernetic dream, then won't that have the effect of desensitizing me to the idea of dying?
That seems to be the general idea,
Breck said, nodding.
But fear is a function of self-preservation!
Breck shrugged.
I wouldn't know. Personally, I'd rather depend on knowledge and ability for my survival.
I couldn't argue with the man. He'd been through more hell than I would ever see, and he'd survived it. But then, that was what he'd been designed to do. He was a high-performance model, and I was strictly economy class. I wondered why Coles bothered. A man in his position could easily recruit more hybrids like Breck, or even ordinary humans who were much more suited to the task than I was. Why me? It couldn't have been simply because I knew too much not to be on the inside. I had no illusions that my civil liberties would mean anything to a man like Coles. If he thought it would be more cost-effective to wipe me like a slate, he wouldn't hesitate a moment. I worried away at it on the way back to the hotel. I had stopped at the point where I had a pleasant buzz instead of getting drunk. And that was fortunate, because when I got home, I found out I had company. As I walked in the door, Cass Daniels came out of my bedroom, wearing my black silk robe and carrying two glasses of champagne. She leaned against the doorframe and held one glass out to me. As I took it, the robe fell open, and I saw that she was wearing a sheer black lycra bra and panties, dark stockings, and spiked heels.
Was this more or less what you had in mind?
She said, raising her eyebrow. It felt as if there was something stuck inside my throat. I drained the glass in one gulp. She sipped her drink and watched me over the rim of the glass. Cass, I said. She approached me, holding the glass in her left hand and putting her right hand on my chest. She smiled as she started to undo my shift. Probably supposed to say shirt, but it says shift.
I thought we should get better acquainted,
she said huskily.
All you really know about me is that I'm one of the scanning engineers at Game Control.
She looked up at me and smiled.
But I know a great deal about you.
Her lips came closer. Her slowly moving hand dropped lower as it stroked gently. And there was something nibbling away at the back of my mind. Only I was having trouble paying attention. I felt her warm breath as her lips brushed my cheek and she pressed herself against me.
Wait,
I said. Inexplicably, I felt paranoid and backed away from her, trying to catch my breath.
Why?
She said, letting the robe slip to the floor and reaching around to unfasten her bra. She looked exactly as I had imagined she would look without that loose-fitting jumpsuit. Exactly the way I had pictured her in my mind. Only, I suddenly recalled her saying that she was actually somewhat heavier around the middle. I don't see any love handles. There was no tattoo. Perhaps she had been joking, but I suddenly wondered what would happen if I called Game Control. Would I find out that she was still on duty? She suddenly threw the glass aside and opened her mouth in a snarl. Gleaming hydraulic fangs slid out of her incisors. Her skin became iridescent and developed scales. She was turning into a nightmare plucked right out of my mind. Without thinking, I clawed for my gun and fired. The bullets passed through empty air where she had been an instant earlier and exploded against the wall. And then I felt something climbing up my leg. The thick serpent's body with the travesty of a human female head coiled around me and I wanted to scream, but instead I jammed my gun right into its gaping maw and squeezed the trigger. The back of the creature's head exploded and I kept firing until the magazine was empty. I fell to the floor, trapped by the serpent coils as the creature stiffened in death. I hammered against its body with my empty gun, trying to free myself. After struggling for a few minutes, I managed to extricate myself from the coils, and I stood over the thing, covered with its blood and breathing heavily.
All right, Coles, damn you, I said through clenched teeth. This time, I didn't die.
Only, Coles didn't respond, and the scene did not dissolve around me, and I didn't come out of it lying on a laboratory couch at Game Control. I was still in my hotel room, and there was an alien creature lying dead on my carpet, and I had its blood all over me. I was still shaking when Breck broke down the door. End of chapter.